This ceremony was officiated by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at cmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Well, good morning, everybody. We are in the at the end of our first month of this training spring intensive Ango. And as we do at the end of each Ango session, this is a Dharma encounter. And so this is part of our training, and it's has its roots in meeting the Dharma between student and teacher, going back to the Buddha. And that takes different shapes and forms in different schools of Buddhism. And so in our tradition, this Dharma encounter is a way to, together and publicly and on the spot, to engage in some teaching, in some particular aspect of practice or Dharma teaching. And to invite people who are in training to come up and ask a question or express their understanding in such a way that we're all a part of it. And in that way, we learn from each other, we polish each other, and help to develop our understanding. In face-to-face teaching, which happens on an ongoing basis, that all happens just between the student and teacher. It's held privately, so it's not discussed outwardly. And so this is a way for students to learn from each other, new students, more senior students. And so it's a great way of training. And so I will offer some brief words about what we'll be engaging in today, which is yet to be known by you, and then you will come up and speak in a way that is yet to be known by me. And that makes it very alive and spontaneous on the spot. So drawing from the teaching of Master Dogen, in our theme of this Ango Manifesting Buddha, and this particular teaching that Dogen is focusing on refraining from unwholesome action or ceasing from harm, which is a fundamental principle and a guiding light within Buddhist practice and teaching. And so in that, Master Dogen begins the fascicle by presenting the essence of that teaching, and at the end, he brings forth this story, which is somewhat well known in the Zen tradition, where one day a lay student, Juyi, asked Master Daolin, "What is the essential meaning of Buddha Dharma?" And Daolin said, "Refrain from unwholesome action and do wholesome action." And Juyi said, "If that's so, a 3-year-old child can say this." And Daolin said, "Yes, a 3-year-old child may say this, but even an 80-year-old person cannot practice it." And Juyi bowed in gratitude and left. And then Dogen goes on to say that this teaching has been transmitted authentically from earlier Buddhas to later Buddhas. These are the common precepts in our ancestral school. Later Buddhas received these precepts from previous Buddhas. This is what has been passed down. Transmitting and receiving these precepts is a mutual activity. He said, this is the teaching of all Buddhas, the teaching, practice, and enlightenment of hundreds, thousands, and myriads of enlightened beings. So this very essential teaching, to refrain from unwholesome action, do wholesome action, study, train, realize, mind. And so this teaching is the path of Buddha Dharma. It's the essence of Buddha Dharma, which means practice and training, teachings. How do we refrain from unwholesome action? How do we do wholesome action? How do we purify and realize the mind? Well, we could say training is how we do that. Spiritual training, Zen training. And that takes, or Buddhist training, that takes many different forms. That's been taking place since the time of the Buddha. He established Buddhist training within Buddha Dharma. But within the different schools and traditions and lineages and sanghas, that appears in different ways. And it has changed over the years, over the many hundreds and hundreds of years. And it continues to evolve because it is an ancestral school, meaning it's passed on from person to person. It's not in a particular doctrine, although the fundamental teachings are, and the realization of those teachings, are exactly what is transmitted, mind to mind. But it is a wisdom tradition, a living wisdom tradition. And so, what does that mean? Questions often arise, and have really since the time of the Buddha. And certainly in the time after the Buddha's passing, and on down to this present time. What is training? What is practice? The Buddha's teachings present the fundamental teachings, and they speak to various practices. But as this is a living wisdom tradition taking place within time and place, which is constantly changing, and people, groups of people that is changing within languages and cultures and worlds that are changing, the question of what is practice, what is training, which is often really asking, is this important or essential to training? Is this really Buddha Dharma practice? When we come into practice, anybody who comes in to explore and certainly stay within Zen practice will understand that Zazen is that, right? Otherwise, this won't make sense if a person doesn't understand that Zazen is practice and training. But we do engage in many different forms of practice. We do liturgy. Is liturgy really essential? Is it necessary? Right? Did the Buddha do liturgy? There weren't altars in the time of the Buddha. There weren't images in the time of the Buddha, but unless you count him as the image. We do our practice, something that Dada Roshi drew from our tradition, but brought forth in a very particular way that we call our practice. The Buddha, as far as I've come across in many of the sutras, was not our practitioner. So is our practice an important, necessary, and essential form of training? We study, which certainly is a part of the tradition, beginning with the Buddha, but Zen says that it is a special transmission outside of scriptures with no reliance on words and letters. We do work practice. In the early tradition, work practice was, Dharma was sitting meditation. Work is not allowed. And for us, that's an integral part of our training. For those of you who live outside of this place, that's what you do in your ordinary life. So you come here to engage in Buddhist practice and you find yourself working, doing something that is more or less familiar. Shouldn't we just be sitting? And on. So we can look at basically any aspect of what we currently know as training, experiences training, and ask that question. And then going further, for many years we've been involved in what we now call the Earth Initiative, working within the environment, being advocates and stewards and trying to be responsible members of the larger sangha of this earth and all of its creatures. We have for many years worked in prisons, corresponding, leading meditation groups, in the early years having quite a number of people being released from prison, coming here and being training. Is that Dharma practice? Is that training? The Beyond Fear of Differences work, undoing racism, undoing sexism, undoing various forms of oppression. Is that Dharma practice? Training? We have the Diamond Net, which is a group of Sangha members who strive to take care or support other Sangha members who are ill, who are recovering from surgery, homebound. And so the questions arise. And sometimes they arise from the things that are seen, you know, the things that are part of the Eight Gates, for instance. I mean, I was a musician. And when I came here, I wondered about art practice. I understood art and music from in terms of my own experience of it, but I didn't understand why we were doing it here. But the questions, you know, continue and become larger. So as we engage in some of these various forms of what we could call right action, or what we could just all call training, is Buddhist practice political? Is it apolitical? What does that mean, actually? When we ask that question, what does that actually mean? Should we be involved in the world? Or should we be more cloistered and removed from the world? Right? So there's a very valid and reasonable desire to come here, particularly for those who don't live here, who are immersed to whatever degrees that you are, in the world and all of its involvements and all of its goings on, and come here to find a refuge from that, right? To turn off a bit, to step away, to go into silence, we're just finishing Shashin. And so to have that time of stepping away to go deep into your practice, develop your understanding of this world that we live in and yourself, and then to step back. That's a very important function. There's also the real aspect of our bodhisattva vows and our practice of being in this world that we live in and being participants in it. So what is that? How do we do that? What is that? Is it a balance? Is it a tension? Is it a conflict? And so we can think of various practices and forms of training as the path that lead to awakening. But we can also just reflect on awakening itself, what it is we are enlightened to, which we speak of as freedom from suffering, liberation from dukkha, from some spinning and spinning and spinning in samsara, the realm of desire and pursuit and disappointment and desire and pursuit and disappointment. And so when we reflect on awakening and consider its profound and vast implications. And so if we look at it that way and then consider what is the path that brings us to awakening. So we can think of it as the Buddha laid out the path, the Eightfold Path, and so this is the path that leads to awakening. But we can also look at awakening in an evolving wisdom tradition, right, that is not static, that is taking place within various times and places. And as I spoke about yesterday, in which we are constantly being influenced by and influencing our own time and place, small and large, and ask what forms of practice and training are we doing, need we to be doing, to lead us to that awakening. So what I want to do today is, rather than focusing on everything I just said, these various forms of practice and training, and, you know, not so much getting into, you know, is this or is this not, but rather, what is the essential matter? Because if we understand the essential matter, then that is our ground, that's our basis for understanding or working towards understanding of what we engage as training and practice. It's kind of like our mission statement. You know, we have one. And that mission statement is, in essence, in brief, the realization and the transmission of the Buddha Dharma from generation to generation. That's, in essence, our mission statement. And let me tell you that that is extremely important, and that I, in my role over the years, have actively and deliberately sat down with that mission statement again and again and again in the midst of of things that were happening, of decisions that were needing to be made, of paths that were being taken, and looked very deeply at that statement, that intention, that vow, in terms of what was happening in that moment. And so, in a sense, this is the same thing. What is the essential matter? What is training itself? What is the path? Because if we look at that, what is the basis, then that can help us to have faith in, to understand, to what we're already engaged in, to have a way of looking at and considering things that are happening in here and outside of here, in terms of how do we continue to both hold our reverence and ground within this wisdom tradition, this profound inheritance of practices and teachings and training, and at the same time, and along with and in concert with the meeting today, meeting the circumstances of today. And so how can you express that? What is the path? What is the essence? How can you do that in such a way that it encompasses the whole? Dogen says that all dharmas are all-inclusive. And so if this training is to be really service in our life, it has to be all-inclusive. It has to include all of it. How can you speak of that in such a way that it's a guide for not only yourself, but us, the Sangha? And so what is the way? What is the path? And so we will begin with the Shusa, who will lead us off, and then those of you who are engaged in the Ango. And as we normally do, let's those of you who have done Ango, done Dharma Encounter before, just move a little more slowly so that folks who have not done it and may be moving slowly, as they are, might be shy, some of you might be shy to get up, so that there's a nice sort of blending of folks who are newer, folks who have done this before. Okay? And the chief disciple will do three bows. Everybody else will just need to do one. And Shoshanshi, which you heard reference to, means Dharma Encounter Teacher.
Shoshanshi. It's a complicated question, and I don't think a simple answer will satisfy that question. But when you started talking, I was thinking about, especially for the three pure precepts as a guiding for our lives. But then you said, what's the essential point of our training? And I won't say that this is my final thought about it, but even though someone has called the enlightenment experience as that little thing, I think that that little thing is very important. Because once we realize what our Buddha nature is, that will include everything.
But how can you speak of it without using Buddhist language in terms of what is the essential matter? In other words, the three pure precepts are part of the path.
Yes.
Right? They basically describe both how to practice the path to enlightenment and also how an enlightened being lives, manifests. And the thing of our Ango is manifesting Buddha. But that's, in a sense, you could say, a response to the essential. Right? And so, what is that essential?
Well, the essential, as I understand it, at this very moment, is that I have to take care of myself. Because if I take care of myself, I take care of everything.
And what is yourself? What does that include?
Everything. Everything.
What is everything?
It includes you, it includes all members of the Sangha, it includes the trees, the animals, the stones, everything. If I take care of myself, I take care of everything, and I won't do no harm to all that includes.
So would you then say that anyone who shares that concern is on the path to awakening?
I think that I won't say that they are on the path of awakening, but they will be on the path of embodying the awakened experience.
So one can do that without awakening itself?
No, I think that you can only be inclusive, if that's the word, or you can only take care of yourself once you have that enlightened experience, once you realize who you really are.
Okay. Well, I would just encourage you in speaking to others, when you say the essence is to take care of myself, that you quickly clarify what you mean by that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Shosanji, I received the precepts from you in November, and the Dharma name Saigon from you. It's a name I really like. Thank you. Actually, my biggest fear about receiving the precepts was, what if I get stuck with a name that I don't like? I like it. And the... Yeah, I mean, I found the place, I found the teacher, and I got stuck with his name.
Let's move on and see if we can...
But the meaning, sacred eye, is a strong seeing theme that I need to take on board. And it feels like, and I'll borrow the words from the Anga reading, that my practice right now is about refraining from unseeing, that sort of becoming quite aware that so much of perception is the fog we create, the preoccupations that distract us from seeing, and so on. It's a long list.
And so if that is the essence, then, and you were trying to set forth a path for you to awaken to that essence, what would any of what we're doing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is it. And there's a conundrum, which is...
But how would you consider... what is a conundrum?
The conundrum is sort of living on Mount Trungpa behind the monastery, living the life, coming to every session. You know, it's wonderful. And that as one starts to unsee, or starts to refrain from unseeing and sees... For example, the impact of one's behavior, the harm one causes, that can be rather shattering to plans and lives and how one spends one time. And so I'm grappling with that right now, that balance of being in here and actually doing a bit more to not just stop the harm, but to get on with the other, you know, the other vows.
Right. Yes, and so then that really brings to the fore, you know, what then do we engage in? What do we, how do we train such that, as you're using the term unseeing, right, which we have to understand that when we are in a state of unseeing, we are seeing, right? When we talk about not seeing things clearly, we are seeing something, right? Or a delusion, you know, or is blindness, you know, is not seeing what's before us. But we are seeing something that's before us, right? So we're always experiencing something, right, that seems self-evident, that seems true. And so how do we train, right, if the essential matter is to awaken the sacred eye, how do we train in ways to do that, and such that that happens? And how do we see those things that we have been deliberately conditioned, or, you know, just things happen, conditioned to not see?
Well, I see Zazen as an essential part of it, but in a couple of live cases for me, the sort of shattering of my unseeing came from reading things. In one case, a review of a scholarly article on the impact of consumption on poor people in the world. And it's something I know. It's self-evident if you drive to the suburbs of big cities or to poor areas in the U.S. and elsewhere. But somehow just, I guess, being ready and ripe for that and seeing the dots connected is shattering. Yeah. And
yeah, so in the same way that the Eightfold Path is a path, and Bud Dogen said that you cannot encounter the way if you do not step forward. The path must be, it's like there's a path in front of us, but we're just sitting here, waiting for it to reveal itself to us. And so, Dogen says to step forward to realize the 10,000 things is delusion. For the 10,000 things to step forward and realize itself is enlightenment. From another perspective, to step forward and realize the 10,000 things is enlightenment. To expect the 10,000 things to step forward and realize the self is delusion. May your life go on.
Thank you for your teaching.
Sure, Sanji. So I have to change my question because what he just described was a lot of what I was going to talk about. So I'll talk about something related. I'm having trouble. Someone I love very much is very depressed, and it's primarily because I know that they're deluded and it's being caused by things that they're thinking and believing that just aren't true, and I know that they're not true, but it's very painful for me because I'd love to bring him here if I thought that would fix it, but I don't think that that's really the answer. And I find this a lot, just being around people in constant pain that I know is being caused by their delusion, and witnessing that and feeling kind of helpless, even if I do everything in my power and I'm trying to help them, and I just don't see that it's making an impact. Do I just have to accept it and think that that's just their path, and, I've done what I can do, and or is there something I'm not seeing that I should be doing more of to help?
Mm-hmm. Well, what have you seen in your own path in terms of at what moment do you take responsibility? At what moment do you decide to take a step towards engaging in a way that will to relieve you of your own suffering? Where does that come from? Does it come from the outside?
For my own suffering?
Yeah.
I just sit with it for a really long time and try and see it from as many different perspectives as I can until I can make sense of it.
Before you get to that point, at the moment where you decide, you realize that there is suffering, and you decide you're going to do something, you're going to engage, at that moment, that brings forth that decision. Is that happening within you, or is that happening from influences outside?
Within me, I would say.
Completely? Is it all you?
The urge to try to help?
Yourself. In other words, are you also in any way being influenced by what's happening around you?
Well, absolutely. I mean, coming here and learning about the Dharma, and that's helped me tremendously. I mean, I was in a lot of pain for a lot of years because I was deluded and I couldn't see that. And so, doing this practice has definitely helped me see that much more clearly. And, I still slip into my old ways occasionally, but I definitely catch myself, maybe not immediately, but retroactively, and see, oh, I slipped again,
Okay.
But it's And I feel like there I'm learning, but other people, when I'm seeing them deluded and feeling that I can't, you know, they don't practice the Dharma and they don't, you
know.
That's
why I wanted to go back to that moment. So what you're describing is you're already doing this. Mm-hmm. You already made that decision. The situation you're talking about is how do you help somebody who hasn't made that decision?
Right.
Right? How do you bring somebody to that pivot moment, right, where they decide to choose life? To affirm, you know, to step forward. And so what you said is obviously it has to come from within, but it also there has to be certain conditions outside of ourselves that is supporting that, nurturing that in some way. They may be negative conditions, or they may be supportive and encouraging conditions. I mean, we can be motivated by all kinds of things. But it's important to understand, because in your relationship with this person, there's their internal. But you're part of their external world. You're part of their condition. Right? And so even though we may be trying to help and we may not see what we hope for, we are part of their environment. We are part of their influence. And so just to try and examine how can we be a beneficial influence without trying to control them. Right? And I would also encourage to make a little bit more expansive the delusion. So he's suffering because he's deluded. Well, all suffering is born out of delusion. But that Roshi told me a story years ago of my Zumi Roshi, his teacher, who was sitting in his kitchen in the center of Los Angeles, perhaps after a long day. And someone, a student, just came in and was being kind of obnoxious and, you know, sort of horsing around. What's it like to be enlightened, Roshi? You're an enlightened person. What's it like to be enlightened? And he looked at him and he said, depressing. So, delusion includes everything.
Okay, thank you for your teaching.
Shosanchi, I've been thinking a lot about the gatha unopening of the sutra. You know, where it says the Dharma is incomparably profound and infinitely subtle. And I've been especially thinking about the infinite subtlety of it and trying. And I think that's why Zazen, of course, is so important. And it's just.
What do you mean?
Well, I think, like, the great matter is.
Well, I mean, just for those who may not understand what you mean, what's the relationship between Zazen? And the importance of that in terms of the subtlety.
Well, I think, you know, Zazen, I remember when I first came to live here and I was a new student and just doing session month after month and just, you know, sitting there and, like, feeling like my heart was in a vice and not being able to move and just looking at that and just seeing some of the subtle ways that I behave and the subtle ways that I judge people. Going a lot to do that. And the woman that was just here in front of me spoke about her pain and how this practice has made her look at that. It's hard to, in certain instances, it's hard to see the subtlety of a teaching that's in front of me. You know, like yesterday, for example, I was in Phoenicia and I was going into the gas station and there was this big biker guy standing in the doorway and, you know, he obviously knew I wanted to get by him. And he looked at me, and it was just like, yeah, screw you, buddy. And my first reaction was, like, rage. And I finally got around him and got into the store. And I was thinking, you know, about my reaction to that. And is there something, a subtle teaching in that? Because I live in the world. I don't live here. And I'm bombarded, as we all are, with that kind of thing every day.
Right. So did your reaction give you any insight into what his inner world must be like?
Yeah, I mean, he's in pain, you know?
And did you see your reaction as
maybe I'm in pain, too?
The same thing.
Yeah, it was.
You dug in his heels.
And I dug in mine. Yeah, exactly, I did. And I never would have seen that, you know, before Zen practice.
So you say sometimes it's hard to appreciate the subtlety of the teachings, but take that into a form of practice or training that you don't really get. You know, like, why this? Why are we doing this?
Yeah, I feel that way some days.
Yeah, because that's part of what training is. You know, there's a sense that, you know, so we do the eight gates, or the Buddha taught it teaches the Eightfold Path. And so that every practitioner is equally engaged in every aspect of the Eightfold, every aspect of the Eight Gates. And that's just not true. Mm-hmm. You know, people, you know, everyone, you know, all of this notwithstanding, you're in charge of your own mind.
Right.
Right? So you can sit on that cushion and, like, you know, be writing the next script.
I can.
Right? and so I remember talking to somebody who was just getting ready to be the chief disciple, or maybe they had already begun. Yeah, I don't begun, I don't remember. But it was either, it's very close or they were in it. And I was asking them about their art practice, and they said, oh, I don't do any art practice. And I said, you've been practicing for years. I said, yeah, I don't really. I don't get it. Right? And so that's, I mean, that's, does it surprise me? Just because, you know, people are going to feel an affinity or feel drawn to or might feel resistant to, you know, different aspects of practice and training in different ways. And then what they do with that, you know, becomes very, you know, is what they do and whether that opens up for them or not. But so how do you take that appreciation of the subtlety into some aspect of actual practice and training, which means you're doing something that you don't, which you don't really get. It's like, why are we doing this?
Yeah.
You know, what does this have to do with the essence? What does this have to do with the great matter? So have you had that experience?
Well, I have, yeah. I mean, I
so what did you do?
Well, I try to practice it as best I can. I mean, when I'm in a situation, like, I find, you know,
But why? Why do you try and practice it as best you can?
Because I want to be a better person so I can be, I mean, I want to, how do I want to say this? You know, just to give you an example to answer your question, like I will sometimes be very judgmental of people that I see as, you know, being, well, they're not so important, you know, and they may have something to communicate to me, and I'll kind of half listen, and I'll seem like I'm listening. Mm-hmm. And I won't be really listening to them because I'm judging them before I even hear what they have to say. Mm-hmm. And if I can stop and see, just to listen to what they're saying, and maybe there's some very subtle messages that I can gain from that.
So
that's a practice that it's been difficult for me, and it's been very rewarding at the same time.
So there's the faith and the trust and the experience of having closed the door. There's nothing here for me.
All right.
Right. Or I don't get this. Or I do get this, and it's not, you know, it's not worth my time. This is not going to actually help me on this path.
Right.
And then based on something, you open that door a little bit. You allow a little bit in. You listen to that person.
Mm-hmm.
And that something is faith. There has to be some measure of faith that there is something in this that will help you do that. You know, in the Fascicle, Dobie says, when you listen, study, practice, and realize unsurpassable complete enlightenment, it is deep, vast, and wondrous. You learn this unsurpassable enlightenment either by following a teacher or by following a sutra. And so faith in Buddhism is not blind. It's faith that isn't verified through practice. But it is faith that there is something, a teaching or someone, a teacher who has done what I want to do or followed the path that I want to follow. I remember being at a teacher's conference years ago, and there was a lot of, you know, this about we need to get young teachers out there, you know, really young teachers out there. And I'm thinking, I don't want to study with somebody who's still learning to make their bed. You know, somebody could be young and enlightened, but just that young itself seemed to be the criteria. You know, so that people could relate. You know, if I'm a young person, I want to relate to a young person. Of course, that makes sense. We want to be able to relate. But that I wanted to study with somebody who had done a lot more than me, right? In every way possible, in every way that I could hope for. And so having that faith is part of what entering into training is. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there were parts of training that I didn't really get. I thought, well, this is definitely most important. This is, and this mm-hmm. is like sort of down here yeah. somewhere. But my teacher would say, no, all of this is important. We're going to set aside time for all of this. And so part of me was like, why does he say that? Why does he think this is important? Because I don't get it. Mm-hmm. And that faith in him and my trust in him was what helped me to stay open to it and engage it.
Yeah, and there are times, too, when I felt, you know, like, why do I do this? Why have I been doing this for so long? And there's something that just keeps me going. I don't know what that is.
That old question.
Amen. Thank you,
Shosanchi. Shosanchi, thank you for bringing up Daito Roshi this morning and Open Sozan and nourishing us. And, you know, an amazing man with these... with, you know, the vision he had and his vows, extremely exemplary, but then you are as well. And you continue to inspire me, and I'm indebted to you for your life of service and everything that you have sacrificed and given up and uphold. And I mean, there's one little story that I want to say that just came to mind with back when we were at Temple University with a small group from Philadelphia. And it was the first time we were meeting there, and there was a bus outside, musicians. And so we all started walking up to, you know, find the room, and we're waiting in the lobby, and the musicians were filtering in, and you come around the corner with holding a snare drum with this big smile on your face, and I was just like, yeah, here, you know, I've already been living with the vows, but here's an example of how I can be doing more all the time.
Well, I am indebted in turn. You know, I was just saying to somebody earlier this week that, you know, I was the last person that I thought would be living their lives within a sangha. I was more solitary by nature. Solitary things were things that I liked to do. I was not a big group person. I definitely wasn't a big joining person. I definitely wasn't a religion joining person. It was a pretty sealed mm-hmm. case.
Yeah. Yeah.
And lo and behold, you know, I realized that what I needed, so much of what I needed was you. So much of what I needed was you. Mm-hmm. And that I didn't understand that that it is a mutual mm-hmm. activity. Mm-hmm. And continuing to understand that, you know, yeah. Is it.
Yeah, you awakened Buddha. I did.
Very lovely.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanji, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was finishing my grocery shopping, and the cashier, she wasn't like the usual person that you would hear from and say, have a good day, something like that. But she handed the receipt to me, and she said, this is your story. And so I said, good, wow. And then, so what's inside? So, but then, during the weeks, I listened the two names that invited me to look at what's inside this bag, and that's my daily life. And the news one is that a whale was killed, and inside its stomach there was about almost 100 pounds of plastic bags. And so how can I relate the food that I eat? How do they pack? Where are they from? How I consume my life that connect with the death of this well? And then I can see, okay, I look at myself, okay, I'm pretty good. I use my own bag, no plastic bag. But how about the bags being thrown out everywhere we can see? And the other news is that the news was the country Malaysia was in fire because it's burning by that recycled things that's been shipped from all these developed countries into this.
Okay, so what is, having just finished this session, having sat here all week and recognizing this, what's the connection? Why sit here all week on this cushion?
I think,
given what you're seeing and how it affects you. Yes.
The sitting here, it allowed me to see it, what's really inside of me I care. I care about life. I care about how to live a life that, what do we say, happy life, have a good day. What is good day? And I found that my life, that I live a day that is in a neutral day that we cannot see. It's not harmful, and it's not wholesome. It's not wholesome. It's just normal day because we don't see it.
But that doesn't mean that it's not having an effect.
It does have, I see, we don't see it. So what now, during the sittings, I can see that this numbness is actually waking up.
Mm-hmm. And then in that waking up, right, the pain,
yes,
that comes forth, how do we hold that pain? How do we really care deeply and not create more suffering?
Sanchi. As I was waiting online, the thing that really I got hooked on is the intention related to doing good. Because, I mean,
to doing good.
And I can look at our life. Kudo and I, we did good. I mean, we took care of parents, and there were different. I could see different energies in me on why I was doing it. I mean, it would seem initially at the time like I was doing it spontaneously, but there were not. That wasn't always the case. Sometimes it was because I had a baggage. Because I was looking for something in return.
So Sancho was talking about the subtleties, you know, to see. You know, as Dogen says, what we see is determined by the extent of our ability to see. And that's on every level, whether we're talking biologically, whether we're talking spiritually. And so when we see with a limited view, the world is limited. And when that view is heavily jaundiced, right, then it's a jaundiced world. And so, and it is always jaundiced in favor of what we call the self, to protect, to defend. And so, and everything else becomes collateral damage, more or less. And so the implications of that are profound, not just for an individualized, but for everything and everyone around us. Mm. Evidence A, our world,
yeah.
Right? And so, as Dr. Rishi used to often say, an unexamined mind is a dangerous thing, truly. Mm-hmm. And so that's where, as Wendell Berry says, well, how do we proceed knowing that we're in a constant state of developing, of gaining more understanding, of learning more? To know that what we see is limited, even as we're developing confidence. And he said the way to proceed is with humility. You know, to proceed knowing, having faith in what our capacity to see, but also knowing that it is also limited.
Yeah, I see that, and it makes complete sense when you say it. I'll examine and then get completely. If we're overwhelmed with my sense of inadequacy and helplessness because it's so big.
Well, that's why living with having Sangha is so important. One, because this self gets reflected back. And also because we see that we're not alone in that. We're not unique. Right?
Yeah.
And so that intention and impact becomes so important. And that's why it's important to have as much of the world here in this room. Right? So that we're having influence and being influenced by, in the same way that we want as profound a dharma, right, that understands as deeply and as broadly as possible. You know, we want all of the treasures, the three jewels are like that. So Sangha too is like that. So as the Sangha becomes more and more representative of the world that we actually live in, then we prosper from that.
Yeah, thank you for your answer.
Shosanji, somewhere in my late teens and increasingly so, it seemed like the universe was always listening and watching. So anything that I was thinking or doing, my interactions, they were revealed in the world. And I must say, with different gates of practice, that has accelerated in various ways. And the question is, how can this be less scary? Because I am thoroughly terrified of the things that come through this, because there's nowhere to hide.
But terrified of what, actually? What is the fear of what might happen?
That is a good question. everyone sees everything.
Well, what if I said we already are? Cat's out of the bag. Right? It's released.
Not wanting to do anything that's harmful. Mm-hmm. It's already out of the bag.
Yeah. Well, that's good. It's good to not want to create harm. And so that's important. And also then to develop the ability to take responsibility when we do, because we will, as we walk this actual, real path, more real than we have bargained for. But if the fear is also that we might see ourselves to be some things that we don't want to see, then we can just reflect and realize, well, whatever I might be afraid of that might be there, if it's there, it's there already. And so do I benefit from not knowing? Do I benefit from not seeing that? Not really. And so, again, cat's out of the bag. And so, better just get on with it.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shou San Chi. Your question, one of your questions was, what is the essence? And usually every day something comes up that I say, oh, that's the essence of what of practice. Or most of the things you say I said, okay, that's it. You know, they're just constantly, that's it, that's it, that's it. I was listening to an old talk of Dido's from the 90s, and he ended it with, you know, in his stern, heavy voice, he said, "You are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha." You know, and that to me is one of the many essences. And I turned that into a ringtone, actually.
And so, seeing that, understanding that, then, what do we mean by Buddha? What are all of the necessary ways that we understand the Buddha? What are all of the essential ways that we understand Dharma and Sangha? Mm-hmm. Because if we don't understand them, again, in that, in as deep and as broad a way, then we're putting something outside of it. We're limiting it, right? And then the question becomes, which is really, you know, what I was hoping to do in this Dharma encounter, is that how does that inform us? How does that bring us back into what is practice? What mm-hmm. is training? What are the things that we need to be doing?
Right.
Right. Are those things that we've inherited? Do those continue to be the things? I think mm-hmm. yes. Are there other things that we need to be doing? I think yes. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, in that way, I reveal that the subject of this mantra, this Dharma encounter, was not innocent. I have an agenda. which was, but as an actual question, a living question. It's a question I live with all the mm-hmm. time, right? Dynamically, you know, as we are meeting today, as we are holding yesterday, and as we are preparing tomorrow, what do we need to be doing? What are mm-hmm. we doing? And how do we do that in the best way possible? What are we not seeing? Right? What am I not seeing in here? What are we not seeing within ourselves? What are we not seeing more largely? And what are the conditions that are fostering that or making that possible to continue? What are the conditions that would help shift that? Right. I mean, in a sense, that's what all the Buddhist practice and training is. How to see what is unseen. Mm-hmm. How to reveal what is hidden. That's what enlightenment actually means, to illuminate what is hidden.
Thank you for your teaching.
So Sanji, as a lay practitioner, I can't deny, and it feels like the fundamental force in my life is karma. So Dogen teaches, the precepts teach, do no harm, do good. For no other reason than is self-centered, when I act in a certain way, I get a certain response. And when I act in a different way, I get a deeply different response. So that's very motivating. What's confusing to me, and in terms of my life, is this profound teaching of emptiness. Why is it that karma is not enough, because it's so obvious and clear? What is this teaching of emptiness, and why is it so important, or what is it, and how is it that its importance is equal and such a fundamental part mm-hmm. as is karma?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of like if... One way of looking at it is if people came in to train and we give them a beginning instruction, we say, fold your legs and put your hands here. It doesn't mean anything. I mean, it has no purpose. But just do that. Mm-hmm. And then focus on your breath. For no reason at all. And then come in and we're going to give you a sutra book and you're going to chant these words, but they don't mean anything. And we're going to do prostrations, but it's just a gesture. Purposeless. It doesn't mean anything. Just do it. Right? Then we could do that. And we could blame some, you know, we're part of a community, we're enjoying doing things together. You know, it gives us something to do. And so we find some value in that. It's like, oh yeah, no, this is like, this is good. And not know that all the while we are standing on in the midst of this vast, vast ocean of wealth that is close to us, right? That is us, but it's dark, right? And so not understanding emptiness on every level is kind of like that, is that there is this fundamental basis that everything is and everything arises from and is the basis of suffering, is the basis of alleviation of suffering, is the heart of compassion, is wisdom itself, and is dark to us. And so given that, we will do the best we can because we're well-intentioned people. And we are in the midst of this vast wealth of not just possibility, but actuality. But it is hidden from us. Mm.
Thank you for your teaching.
There's a line from this fast forward study which connects with what Sam was just asking about. Though he says, do not think that to face a person is to understand a person. Do not think that not to face a person is not to understand a person. To not face a person is to let go of all of our ideas, projections, histories, understandings, beliefs, things that are seen and things that are unseen, things that we recognize within ourselves, things that we don't even have a clue about. To let go of all of those and not face a person is to not face ourselves, is to realize our essential nature. So that then when we face a person, we understand the person. When we face ourselves, we understand ourselves. And so we could say that that is the essence. The Buddha realized that the self, the attachment, the grasping, the illusion of the self is the source of all suffering. But getting to that which is unseen, how do you, in the middle of a dream, how do you know that you're dreaming? How do you awaken to the fact that you're dreaming within the dream? Particularly if it seems like a good dream. This is going well. And so that is the great challenge of the Buddha Dharma. I think that's part of why the Buddha said he would not teach after his own enlightenment. He said that as he can survey the landscape, he said, we are too enchanted by our attachments. We're too enchanted and enthralled with our unseeing, as Sagan said, with our not seeing. And that when that eye begins to open, it's frightening, it's disturbing, it is unsettling, it is, as the Buddha said, a revolution. And from a distance we can think, that's okay, I'm up for that. I've been on adventures before. But we really don't know what we're talking about. Just like I didn't know what I was talking about. If you're my teacher, say that. I'd say, yeah, let's do this. Let's just do it. And then in a very ordinary, miserable moment, I had no idea that that's what was happening. I didn't remember what he said. He says, yeah, I told you. I told you this was what was coming. I told you this was what this... I didn't get it. But that was seeing things that were just appearing to me. Just appearing to me. What about those things that do not appear to us? And so, you know, some of the I mean, obviously the questions about political and apolitical and, you know, the Beyond Fear of Differences work that we're doing, the Earth Initiative, that brings us into the world, that brings us into our history, our karma, our politics, our government, our institutions, our world. And I think this is a really, really essential question. And when I said my purpose today was not innocent, but it's also not concluded. In other words, this is a living, we are a living thing. Sangha is a living thing. training is a living thing. And there is the respect for what we have and maintaining that and strengthening that so that we pass it on as vital and vibrant as can be. And also that it is responding to the world that we're in. And we are in a world. Heaven help us. This world that we're in. And so, Avalokiteshvara is the one who hears the cries. What are the cries that we are hearing? The earth is crying. Black Lives Matter, that's a cry. Me Too, that's a cry. These are cries. And they are not here by accident. They are here by purposeful, deliberate, chosen actions. Generation after generation. And now here we are. And it's always been like that. Every sangha is the recipient of their karma, individual and collective, and also the holders of the future of Buddha Dharma. And the enlightened society that we are committed to taking steps towards. And so, I just want to encourage us to not be afraid of examining ourselves and to welcome the opportunities to do that. And that when we feel threatened by that, that's a signal. That's a message from within. Don't go there. Don't go there. Right? Keep that door shut. And so that's, as a Dharma practitioner, that's where our courage is called for. That's where our trust is called for. That's where we are accountable.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.